Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show alive and kicking at newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, how do you know you're in the right job? And if you're not, how do you jump? And how do you even know where to go? I'll be joined by the career psychologist Sinead Brady. The Year of Care campaign, calling for greater supports for mothers in the first year of parenthood, has had a significant couple of weeks. I'll be joined by its founder, Eilish Gormley, to hear about the latest developments. And at the opposite end of the scale, we're going to be tackling a somewhat taboo topic and discussing end-of-life care with two palliative care nurses. And we'll be talking about care in a hospice and care at home. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, probably one of the best I've had in a long time, I must say. I am still coming down from the fabulous weekend at the Would You Be Well retreat in Wicklow. It is the most stunning setting, I think. It's no wonder we call Wicklow the Garden of Ireland. As soon as I start to drive into it, I start to feel my shoulders come down. I just loved it. So that was the backdrop for it all. To the people who came, some of whom listened to the show, so a very good morning to Evelyn and to Mary Therese. Some had just seen or heard some interviews around my book, or indeed read my book. Some people were dragged by their friends and had never heard of me in their lives, and that was absolutely fine too. And I had a couple of my own friends who came. My sister flew home for the weekend from the US, so it was all very special. And the group really got on, they got involved, and I truly felt emotionally attached and so grateful to them all. And I won't name him, but we did have just one man among women. And I just wanted to say, why don't more men go on retreats or to wellness events? I just don't get it. I think they deserve it as much as anybody else. He was there with his wife and they did say that indeed they had a great time. But more men, please. The facilitators I'd invited along, Emma West gave us a sound bath, Daniel Davey gave a talk on performance, Luke Walsh brought us forest bathing, and Nisha Nivrin brought her techno yoga. They were all incredible, as I knew they would be, and I'm so grateful to them for being a part of what I really saw as a culmination and a celebration of the last 7 years that started here presenting this show, what I've learned about health and wellness and writing of the book. And I have to say, it all came together better than I had imagined. So I have been grinning all week. Now, can we talk about Lent? Are people giving up things for Lent, for indeed religious purposes or otherwise? I know for some people it is intrinsically linked to their faith, and I have the utmost respect for that. But I know for others, they see it as a chance to step away from something. People will often choose, you know, chocolate or sweets, or, you know, it's in the same vein perhaps as Dry January. And I heard somebody talking on Instagram and saying that their wife had given up Instagram for Lent and, you know, was asking him, could she see certain things at certain times on his Instagram? And that got me thinking, do many embrace Lent in this way? I'd love to hear from Alive and Kicking listeners. Have you given up something for Lent? Was it for, you know, religious purposes? Or did you just use it as a chance to perhaps bring in something that you're considering to be a little bit of a better way to live? Email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, we talk a lot about preparing for birth, the scans, the appointments, the plans, but what about the year after the baby arrives? In recent weeks, the Year of Care campaign has moved to the floor of the Seanad with cross-party backing and growing political momentum. Its founder, Eilish Gormley, says we need guaranteed, structured support for mothers for the full first year after birth. And Eilish joins me in studio now. Eilish, you're very welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Claire. Great to be back.
So you did come on, and people can listen back if they want to, and you explain, you know, why you went down this road. Your own personal story is very much behind this. And as I say, you have had a bit of momentum in the last while. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely, Claire. I suppose from since I was in with you the last time, I suppose I really feel like it started with one voice, it started with me, and it has very much so grown into mothers' voices across this country that are really fueling the campaign and driving it forward. So since I last spoke to you, since I was last in, there's been a lot of interest in the campaign politically, I suppose, and there's been a lot of interest in actually doing something real and concrete with what the campaign is looking for. So it's really positive.
Because this is an investment in our future. Not only do those women deserve that, but so do their children and, you know, the people around them. Like, this is a huge ripple effect, not only in the family unit, but in society at large.
Massively. You know, that's the big thing. It's not just, although this is a campaign for mothers, it really isn't just about mothers. You know, it has how a mother feels in terms of whether she is supported or not after having a baby has, as you say, massive ripple effects. It affects the family, it affects partners, mental health, economically, you know, as well. Like, there's lots of ripple effects, absolutely.
So let's talk about some of the stats then, because this is born out of research, not just your own personal story of what you've heard anecdotally. Tell us a bit about this Europe-wide study.
Yeah, so Make Mothers Matter, which are an international NGO, they conducted a study recently on the state of motherhood in Europe. So they looked at 11 countries, and Ireland was one of those countries. And the findings are really shocking. You know, Ireland ranked very low in that survey in terms of how mothers felt in terms of their support. So, you know, in terms of anxiety, depression, burnout, feeling structurally supported by policy in the country, Ireland had one of the lowest rankings in that survey. So, yeah, so it's really important that we're shining a light on it now, I think.
What are some of those structures and policies that would make a real difference?
Yeah, so I suppose what the Year of Care campaign is advocating for, essentially, Claire, is that when mothers leave hospital with that new baby, that they know when they're leaving that hospital what support is available to them for the next year ahead. You know, that's one of the biggest issues we have in this country, is that support is patchy. Support, it depends on your postcode. It depends on who your public health nurse is, who your GP is. Some women, you know, have great experiences. Other women don't. Some women know where to look for help. But women shouldn't have to, you know, like, we're very much so, we need to self-identify, self-advocate, you know, find the resources ourselves. But women really need to know what support is there for them when they're leaving hospital, and to feel that they're supported by the system in terms of, if they're struggling with their mental health, that there is support there for them. If they're struggling with their physical health, that there is support there for them. And the community side of that as well, that there's community supports in place to support mothers.
Yeah, and for lots of, you know, parents, mothers, the experience can be challenging, it can be difficult, but eventually it can all settle down. But I listened recently to a podcast, The Motherload. I'm a really big fan of it. The mom on it was talking about really struggling from the hospital on, and she had a psychology background. So she knew when her thoughts were getting to a stage that was quite dangerous. She ended up in a psychiatric hospital. But after receiving support and well-intentioned care there, she's still left with no answers. And it's only through her own retraining, and eventually she has recently been diagnosed as neurodivergent, and that has filled a lot of the pieces of her personal jigsaw. But she had the wherewithal, she had the privilege, she had the accessibility to all of these supports. You're saying for every mother, this should be the norm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really good point in terms of, you know, that woman having all the resources and having that, you know, knowledge about herself, I suppose, as well at a deeper level. But in particular, Claire, marginalised groups, you know, there are groups that this really affects. Like, if you are in a position to pay for care in this country, you are in a better position. Not the best position all the same, but you are in a better position. But for the people who can't afford to pay for, you know, private birth trauma specialists or, you know, private physio or private mental health care, you know, those people are really left, those mothers are really left isolated. So that's why a year of care, a structured support system, like I would call it, it's a roadmap for postnatal care in this country. It's a vision for postnatal care in this country for every mother, so that every mother is entitled to and has access to the same support no matter where she lives.
And just to give some of those key findings, in relation to Ireland, 77% of mothers report feeling mentally overloaded. We were among the top three European countries for maternal burnout and anxiety, and 61% of mothers report insufficient societal and policy support. I mean, that is shocking, because we consider ourselves very warm, friendly. I know our maternity hospitals are ranked really highly, and our midwives, and there are so many wonderful people working within that system, but we're falling short. What about some of the countries that performed higher? What are they, and what are they doing to support their mothers?
Yeah, I suppose one of the biggest things is, and one of the biggest aspects that the campaign is looking at is maternity leave, paid maternity leave. So some of the countries that are performing very well, they are offering better maternity leave to mothers. So a lot of countries will offer a year and beyond of paid maternity leave. In Ireland, it's 6 months of paid maternity leave with the option then of taking unpaid leave for most mothers. And that's a massive factor, Claire, because you have a lot of women who are, I would speak to a lot of mothers who have to return to work 6 months after their baby is born, not because they want to, but because financially they're crippled with mortgages and, you know, just trying to pay the bills. So they have to go back to work, but they don't want to go back to work. And that in itself can kind of start off, you know, start a mother feeling, you know, anxious, worried, overwhelmed. You know, we're very much so expected to have it all and do it all as mothers in this country. And there is, you can see from the statistics in that survey that there is a price to pay for that. That's why the burnout, that's why the anxiety, that's why those levels are so high, I think.
Yeah, I'm that's why there's less women in leadership. I really believe it. And even though we have made great strides when it comes to gender equality and parental leave, it still is mainly falling on the mother if you're in a heteronormative relationship, and one person in particular to be that stay-at-home parent and then try and work on top of it while being the house manager and taking on the mental load. And as you say, if you add on any sort of trauma or need for extra support, then it's not there. So it's just really, really impossible. So tell me a little bit about the event that happened on Tuesday.
Yeah, so we held an event, Maternal Wellbeing in Ireland, From Evidence to Action. So really what the event was focusing on was looking at kind of where we're at now, looking at the evidence, looking at the state of motherhood that we just spoke about there, looking at different things like the National Maternity Experience Survey and other research. And I suppose looking at motherhood across a very broad spectrum, I suppose, from when a mother is pregnant right through to after she has her baby to further on in terms of flexibility, in terms of remote working, in terms of access to childcare. So the idea of the event was to look very broadly at the whole picture and then looking at the evidence. You know, we had some excellent speakers there to talk about it, and then also then moving to action. So the Year of Care campaign is only one of those movements to action. So I suppose the campaign is calling for improved postnatal care.
You, as you said, are not just Year of Care. You're starting to join up with other organisations. So who was also represented there?
Yeah, so the event was the Year of Care campaign in collaboration with the Irish Maternity Support Network. So they do great work in supporting mothers also. And then Make Mothers Matter, who we spoke about, who did the survey. And then we also had contributions from the National Women's Council, you know, as well, just because there are many stakeholders, I suppose, many people involved, and the more people that are involved and on board, the better.
So what about the action piece then? Because, I mean, it's great, as I said, that you've got a bit of political interest, that you're gathering numbers, that people are interested, you've got a framework. When will something like this come into action? Because I do find, even with the best will in the world, when it comes to policy change, the wheels move so slowly.
Yeah, absolutely. So at the moment, the Social Democrats are looking at bringing a motion to the Dáil, looking to a pilot scheme of the Year of Care. So to pick, you know, a number of places in Ireland and to roll out a pilot scheme of the campaign to see what it would look like to have increased checkups for mothers, better access to mental health support, better access to physical support. So at the moment, that's what we're working towards, is getting support for that pilot scheme to trial it first.
Yeah. And look, you have to just keep hope and keep pushing, don't you? How do you find navigating that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose I'm really encouraged by, Claire, by all the stories that I get. I get stories every day from mothers sharing their own experience of care or lack of care. And that's really my main motivation, you know, is to keep going. As I say, it started with my voice, but it's very much so not just my voice anymore. There are so many mothers, you know, and there's that will and that drive comes from seeing that the system is broken, that it has been for a long time. You know, I spoke to a mother recently who told me about her sister who, you know, 24 years ago had to be admitted to a psychiatric unit because she was unwell after her baby was born. And she said to me, you know, we've really moved on from that now, though. And I said, how do you mean? And she said, that wouldn't happen today. You know, her baby would be with her. And I said, it would still happen today, because still in this country, despite calls from 2016 and beforehand, we don't have a mother and baby psychiatric unit. The UK have 24, And based on our population, we should have three in this country. And we don't even have one. And, you know, progress is imminent. I suppose a site has been decided at St. Vincent's Hospital. But still in 2026, to think that we still don't have one of those units for mothers who are really struggling after their baby is born, that's really sad. And so it's situations like that, it's hearing stories like that from mothers that motivate me to keep going with it.
Yeah, and I do believe it won't be another 24 years before real change happens. But I think as well, Ailish, it's really important to say that even while you're pushing for system and policy change, you're building awareness and you're having conversations. And even us having this, there's going to be mothers listening who will say to themselves, I'm not alone. It's okay for me to struggle. It's okay for me to need support. And yes, we're shouting that sometimes those supports are still out of reach, but I think it gives them that validation that it is normal to not feel okay and be a mother. And that's also who you're fighting for. And I think you're amazing for doing it. And thank you so much. And for having me a part of the event this week. And I'm always in your corner. Where can people find out more and support you?
Yeah, so they can go to the Year of Care website, which is yearofcare.ie, or they can follow the Year of Care campaign on Instagram or Facebook as well.
Founder of Year of Care, Ailish Gormley. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And you can look online to find and look at the rest of that research. It's the State of Motherhood in Europe study.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, on paper, your career might look fine. You like the people, the pay is good, but something feels like it's missing. What if success doesn't feel the way you thought it would? If you're ambitious but quietly exhausted, driven but disconnected, how do you know if you're in the wrong job or just the wrong season? Sinead Brady is a career psychologist and she joins me on the line now with her advice. You're very welcome, Sinead.
Thanks for having me, Claire. I love having these conversations.
I'm allergic to new year, new you. But I know in the turn of a year, people are like, right, you know, are there changes I need to make? And often we begin to look at our work, our career, our job and think, is there something that needs to change here? But do you think it's really important that the first step is we reframe the question?
Yeah, 100%. Reframe around the questions that we're asking. So yeah, is this the right career? So very often what happens is, you know, we step into a career, maybe 17 or 18, after doing the Leave and Search, you know yourself, filling out the CAO form and whatnot, step into a career. And actually, we don't really reach our cognitive maturity or our maturity as an individual until we're about 25 or 6. So suddenly we're sitting at 25 or 6 going, I'm not sure if this is the right career for me. But really what you're asking and the question that's most pertinent is this career aligned with who I am during this season of my life? Because your career evolves just as your identity evolves. And what you needed when you were your younger version of yourself may not be what you need now or want now. So as you shift and change during the different seasons of your life, so too does what you want and what you need from a career. So, and careers evolve as well, Claire. You know, we sometimes think of careers as these very static things, but they're actually these living, breathing, really interesting spaces through which we live part of our life, not all of our life. So part of our identity is explored through our career, but not all of it.
And before you consider jumping careers or, you know, leaving your job or making any big changes, you suggest starting to look at how you're living. So when you give career advice or you run programs with people, you look at a very holistic view of life, not just the career.
Absolutely. And this is like your career is part of your identity, not all of it. So when you are thinking about your career, you're thinking about it in a very specific way. And your career begins with understanding physically what you need. And I call them your three P's, three non-negotiables that you need. They're physical, personal, and then and only then your professional non-negotiables. So your physical starts off with the basics of well-being that, you know, we all kind of know to be true. So it's, are you, I call it NEST. So are you nourishing yourself? Are you exercising? Are you sleeping? And then do you have the energy to spend time with people who make you smile? Because if you're nourishing yourself, if you're exercising and if you're sleeping, and I don't mean, like, I love Instagram, but I don't mean the Instagram version of that, like the perfect nutrition, the perfect exercise, high rocks. And if that's your thing, that's fine. But this is just basic movement, getting fresh air, getting steps in. And when you have those basics right, everything else feels better. And then personally, do you know what you need financially from your career? Do you know what your work tempo looks like? You know, and that doesn't mean that you're going to get all of these things. They're not a list of demands, but it's at least when you know what you are deciding upon for yourself, you then make choices rather than sacrifices. And then professionally, are you in a season where you need growth, development, and or progression? And what is most important for you? But until you get the physical and the personal right, the professional, you just won't feel connected to it.
And what if your job is encroaching on all of that? It's, you know, sucking all of your energy from the other people in your life, as you said, who light you up. You're not sleeping right. You're not getting exercise or fresh air. You'd understand why people would be saying, you know, this is the job that needs to go. I can't fix one without fixing the other.
Yeah, and this is really interesting because we have to then look and again, take a step back. And this is, you know, as a psychologist, a work in organisation psychologist, understanding this from within the context of your overall identity. Your job, your career actually is made up of numbers of different parts, but there's the function of what you do and then there's the environment that you do it in. And sometimes what happens is people say, I have to change job, I have to change career, and the two become conflated with each other. But actually, what we need to do is kind of step back a little bit and go, okay, so when I look at the function of what I do, that's the thing that, you know, the technical aspect of your role and what you do. Are you enjoying that? Again, not 100% of the time, because 100% is too. But if we can get like this sweet spot of between 60 and 80% of the function of what you do, if you enjoy that, that's a really high space to be in. That's great. And then it's to kind of look at it and go, well, what environment am I doing this in? When I look up and look around, is there a good culture? What does the leadership look like? What does the environment look like that I'm performing the function of my career within? And sometimes it is the function of what you do, and that tends to mean a job or a career change. But if it's the environment that's impacting your physical non-negotiables, then it's not about a job or career change. It's actually about moving environment. It's about being in a different work culture. And then suddenly you can look back and go, there's almost a relief. You go, wow, okay, so now I need to think about something very different. I'm thinking about how do I perform this role, perform this career in a safer environment where I can sleep, eat, and move in a way that is just, you know, what you expect in a job or in a role.
I also love that you say avoid binary thinking. There aren't just two options here, you know, stay in the job and be miserable or leave immediately. That there has to be a little bit of nuance there.
Yeah, there really does. And again, in all the work that I do, let that be with individuals or within organisations, we look at how your role is designed. We look at job crafting. So are there small things that you can do that can actually have a massive impact on your role? And then are there boundaries that you can set? So very often what I find is that there's an awful lot of hidden and invisible tasks sitting within jobs and roles. And sometimes you are the person who is relied upon for those invisible tasks to be done. But again, you have an element of control over some of this and you can say, okay, so this is where I'm going to redraw the boundaries here so that I can do less of these invisible tasks that are really hard to kind of KPI or explain to anybody, but they keep me super busy. And I need to refocus on the work that I am employed to do as such. So you can, again, stay forever or leave immediately is so binary. It just separates the world into very black and white. But there is this, you know, grey space in the centre where there is scope to sometimes make changes in the form of a pilot and go, okay, I'm going to try this for 6 weeks. I'm going to design a part of my role that was in my control and I'm going to see if there's something that I can do across the next 6 weeks that actually changes my relationship with this role. So, for example, I'm working with somebody at the moment and one of the things, she was experiencing rust out, Claire, which is this feeling that she'd been in a job for a long time. She was feeling bored, actually, but the symptoms were the same as burnout. So we began to introduce these small pilots, 6 week pilots into what she was doing. And she has actually written her own job description, gone to her senior leadership team, and she's in the process of negotiating that job description because she spotted a gap between what they were doing and what needed to be done, and she's the perfect person to fill it. So she's not actually going to leave where she thought she was going to leave in the beginning of our work together.
Yeah, and it is an interesting one, but I think people are hesitant to go in, you know, if they're not in a management role themselves, to go into their manager and say, you know, I'm not enjoying work anymore, I'm not coping, or I need to make change, because it sounds negative, but how is that sort of information, perhaps packaged a little better, received?
Yeah, and this is the thing. It's where you begin to kind of step into this position of ownership over your career. So it's going, I can see what's within my control. And then you can have a conversation about, you know, this is where I add value, this is the impact that I have, and this is where I can see that I can add more impact. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're adding on extra things. And like that, Claire, sometimes the right thing to do is to leave. Perhaps that is actually what you need to do if you don't see that there is a possibility of being able to satisfy your physical non-negotiables. But sometimes the only thing to do is to leave. But you need to have an exit strategy if you're doing that. So you don't just kind of walk in, hand in your P45 and hope that something better will come. You have to make sure that you craft the exit so that you're not left in this space of financial difficulty, because you really need to allow time for a career or a job change, whatever one you decide. And I would always say to people, you know, 6 months is probably the minimum that you should allow, whereas 18 months is often the realistic amount of time that you could be in a position of changing. So if you've got 18 months of covering your basics in terms of your bills in the bank, that's fine. Then you can leave. But if you don't, you just sometimes have to look at it and go, okay, so what do I need to do here? If the role is really impacting your mental health, if perhaps you're in a toxic environment, I would suggest a pivot role. That's where you get out and you protect your well-being. And in that space of time that you pivot, you do something that covers your financial costs. So it might be part-time work or contracting work or something else. But really what you're doing is you're making sure that you stay well enough to be able to go into the next role. But if you are able to stay in the role, if it's not impacting your mental health to the point where you feel really, really low, if you can stay, you craft an exit strategy. You don't just walk out.
And a word that you hear a lot now that you think can be dangerous is the word manifest, that people listen, you know, to their intuition, say this job isn't right for me, I need to leave, but then say I'm going to manifest my dream job. And you say, you know, that's all well and good, but you need to have a plan.
You absolutely need a plan. And you know, manifesting, each to their own on the topic of manifesting. But for me, you know, you can manifest, absolutely. So you can have your vision board, you can have your idea about what you want. But unless there is a plan behind that, very often you can fall into a space whereby you don't see what, you know, you don't understand the landscape that you're walking into. So as I said, absolutely manifest a job change, manifest a career change. But manifesting alone won't get you there. If you're going for a job change, you need to have your CV in place. You need to have your LinkedIn. You know, you have to have all those very practical things in place so that when you go for it, you're prepped and you're primed and you're ready for interview. If you're thinking about a career change, it may be that you need to have certain skills built, that you need to have particular qualifications done. So you have to be really, really clear and careful about, yes, you can manifest. Yes, you can vision board. Yes, you can think about what it is that you want at the end. But the steps in between do need to be concrete, they do need to be paced, and they do need to be attached to the reality of the job market and the career landscape that we're living in.
If you want to find out more about Sinead's work, you can go to thecareerpsychologist.co. She also has a brilliant book. It's called Total Reset. Career psychologist Sinead Brady, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, caring for a loved one as they enter their last days can be a challenge, but according to the people who work in palliative care, communication is key to ensuring patients get the support, dignity and comfort that they deserve. To discuss the pros and cons of end-of-life care in the home and in a hospice, I'm joined in studio by Olive Finucane and Nora McCarrick, community palliative care nurses at St Francis Hospice in Dublin, who also support end-of-life patients in the home. Well, you're both very welcome.
Thank you very much.
And the work you do from the outset, let's just say, is absolutely incredible. I'm a dub myself from the north side, and St Francis Hospice is just renowned for being such a special, special place. So thank you for everything that you do. It's a huge undertaking and job. So will you tell me a little bit, Olive, I might ask you first, what led you to work in this area?
Yeah. So when I was finished school, I was back then we were waiting on our nursing place. So you often were put on a panel for a hospital while you waited to get called to do your training. So I had applied to work as a care assistant over in Our Lady's Hospice in Harold's Cross. So I think I was about maybe 18, 19 at that point. And so I went over there, worked as a care assistant, and I was really taken by the place. I loved it. I was really impressed with the care that people received. And I just loved everything about it. And I always thought this is definitely what I'd like to do. So I went on then, did my training, did a little bit of travelling, came back then, worked in the Mater for a little while. And then in 2023, I saw a job for St. Francis Hospice Rohini and applied for that and subsequently got the job. And I've never left.
Really special place. What about yourself, Nora?
Yeah, well, pretty similar. I left school and started nursing in Beaumont Hospital. And when we qualified after a year staffing, then you had to look for another job. So I was a home bird, so I wanted to stick to Dublin. So I applied and got a job. I did the other way around. I went to Harold's Cross Hospice as a qualified nurse. And I worked there for many years while I studied another bit. And then I came back Northside. Like yourself, I'm a Northsider, and I came back to joined St. Francis Hospice Rohini in 1999. So I'm a long time as a community nurse. I joined Rohini as a community palliative care nurse.
And obviously it's a challenging time for families. It's a difficult time, and I'm sure it can be complicated. Every situation is different. But the fact that both of you have stayed in it for so long speaks volumes about the work. Does it become more of a vocation than anything else, Olive?
I suppose I think like we're very focused on quality of life for people. And I suppose, you know, we really want people to live as well as possible for as long as possible. So I suppose when we meet families and meet people in the community, we very quickly try and establish, you know, what their needs are, what the problems are. And we work really hard within a multidisciplinary team to try and go after those symptom issues. I suppose at this point as well, it's kind of important to kind of differentiate between specialist palliative care and more generalist palliative care. So hospice is very much concerned with, it's essentially an extra layer of support, you know, for those with complex symptoms such as pain and breathlessness and psychosocial difficulties and emotional, spiritual distress. So specialist palliative care is really delivering like care delivered by highly trained staff. So our consultants and our doctors, our nurses, physios, OTs, medical social workers, we all kind of work together in terms of providing, you know, the best quality of care for our patient group. I suppose non-specialist palliative care would be lots of people in the community receive non-specialist palliative care. It's more generalist. It's delivered by their GPs, by their public health nurses, by community physios, OTs and social workers. So people with generalist needs, you know, and non-complex needs, they often may not need our service. So it's those with the complex needs are the people in the community that will avail of the hospice services.
And I said in the introduction that we were going to sort of talk about the pros and cons of, you know, hospice versus home end of life care. But sometimes, Nora, that's not necessarily a choice that people can make.
No, it's very much driven by their symptom burden. Some patients with our support, our multidisciplinary support, can die peacefully and comfortably at home with a lot of input from their GP and their public health nurse and our team. Other cases then, if their symptom burden is higher and it needs an inpatient admission, that just has to happen. We will always try to respect the wishes of the patients, and most people really do choose to die in their own home, and that's our specialty. That's what we excel at. And to go back to why we've stayed at it so long is because it's a wonderful job that you know you're making a difference, and that's what has kept me at it for all of the 26, 27 years. And depending on if the patient can stay at home, we'll do our utmost for it to work there. If the patient has to be admitted, we'll make that work too.
Why do you think most people want to die at home?
Well, they've great ownership. The patient and the family have great ownership of the situation they find themselves in. End of life is daunting because we don't have anybody who's ever come back to tell us what it's like. So they feel most confident and most comfortable in their own home. They've also, majority of our patients have been through a long hospital journey, receiving treatments for whatever their diagnosis has been. So they can be very content to be finished maybe with that chapter and to embark upon their last chapter. And that's where we come into our own.
And I said communication is key, Olive. So how do you help people to take on this information and this decision that sometimes is taken out of their own hands, but even to come to terms with the term palliative care? As Nora said, often there's been months, if not years, of treatment, and to sort of say we've reached the end of the line with that. How do you manage that message?
Mm-hmm. And I suppose when we meet patients and families, first off, and they're quite daunted by, oh my goodness, who's going to turn up at the door, or what is this going to be like, or are they coming to give us really bad news or more bad news? And I think often families are really pleasantly surprised that, oh, this is a very normal person at the door. And like that, we develop very nice and very pleasant relationships with families. I suppose we really like to try and ease people's fears around what we represent, because we have so many positive things to offer to patients and their families, and they usually have no idea all of the positive things we can offer. So, for instance, when we first meet people, like we'd meet a variety. Some people might be really quite ill with quite significant symptom burden. When we meet them first, we will work really hard to manage those symptoms and address them. And I think often patients and families are so surprised how quickly we can, you know, reverse particular symptoms that have caused a lot of difficulty, and how quickly, in conjunction with our wider team and our support from our specialist consultants and doctors and the GPs in the community also, who are the main, you know, medical person looking after the person in the community, we can very quickly address symptoms. So families tend to be very relieved, and at the outset, when they're a bit nervous, very quickly they look forward to our visits. I suppose we establish quite quickly on as well in terms of what patients' preferences are. So like where people are able to kind of, you know, have some conversations around all that's happening for them, we like to establish, you know, if there comes a time where you become unwell, or when that time, you know, when that time comes that you become unwell, what would your preference be? Would you rather be in the home, or would you like to come into us in the hospice? So we would have those conversations. We are very focused on trying to help people to live as long as possible with good quality. So we have lots of people now that we visit in the community, and where they're reasonably well in context, they are coming into our outpatient department. They're getting great benefit from attending our physios, our OTs, our complementary therapists. We have so much on offer now to help people live. So our focus is very much on the living, and living with quality rather than on the dying.
Yeah.
So we're very focused on the living piece.
How do you manage differing opinions? I've really taken from both of you that you keep the patient's thoughts at the centre of what's being done, but also you're managing family members who are already beginning a grieving process of sorts, and they may have differing ideas even within family units of what should happen next. How do you manage all of that at such a tricky time?
Well, we have become more skilled communicators, that's for sure, because we juggle a lot of personalities. And you're very right. Adult children can differ in what's best for their parent. So we let things evolve, and we walk the walk with them, and we negotiate gently. We also assess what is best for the patient ourselves. And sometimes with the best will in the world, you know, you have to encourage a decision to be made for the benefit of everybody, for those adult children, for the patient, if it's the elderly parent who's dying at home. We negotiate skillfully, and we collaborate, and we call family meetings, and we would call all the members of the family in, and with the patient's knowledge. We would have our medical lead with us, and we've very skilled social workers as part of the team. And we negotiate, and we journey through it, and we come to the best solution we can.
Yeah, a little guide with the patient at the centre of every decision.
At the center, yeah.
And Olive, is there still plenty of autonomy and control in the hospice setup? It's not like you're going from something that's lovely and cosy at home and that you're more in control of, to loss of autonomy in the hospice. That can still be a very special and comfortable experience for everyone.
Absolutely. And I suppose, like, you know, the patient is at the centre of everything we do. So we are very focused on, you know, where people are able, that they make all the decisions for themselves in respect of their own preferences. We will always go at the pace of the individual that we're visiting too. So people differ. Some people would like lots of information around their illness. They'd like lots of information in terms of, you know, expectation and what's going to happen and what is it going to be like as I become less well. Other people prefer to talk about, where did you get those lovely shoes? And, you know, have you been in the shops recently? And, you know, so it's really individual. So in terms of coming into the hospice, like, very often we get to know families and patients in the community so well that we kind of communicate very clearly with our colleagues who work in the inpatient unit in St. Francis Hospice. And so already they have a sense of this person coming in. So we really, you know, appreciate people's individuality and preferences, and we have documented those preferences.
I often speak on the show about the loss of my father. It's obviously my biggest loss, and the listeners have been with me every step of the way. And he died in a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And I would have thought my preference would have been for him to be at home, you know, with the candles lit. You get this sort of notion in your head. But to be able to have the nursing team on hand, and we still had the grace, we still had the space to be there, but to be able to lean on them and check that he was as comfortable as he possibly could really meant a lot. And we were able to make the room as comfortable for him with all his pictures and duvet and, you know, whatever else, all those little things. So you're bringing bits of home with you as well as yourselves. But the other thing that really struck me from that experience was what a privilege it is to be with somebody at that stage of their life. It almost feels very similar to when a new baby is born. Obviously, there's a lot of big feelings with it and a lot of sadness and grief to say goodbye to somebody as opposed to welcoming a new life into the world. But you must witness that privilege every day as part of your job. It's something, as you said, we can't avoid. It's coming to all of us. So to be there walking the walk with people is something very special to do.
Oh, absolutely. And it is a privilege. And you never, ever get used to it. All the years later, I'm always very honoured to be in the presence of the family and to have made a difference, that the patient's going was easy and that their dying was easy. To go back to your point about your dad having a nice experience in the nursing home, that is part of our remit. We visit the patient wherever their home is, be it in a nursing home, in their family home, in a prison, in a homeless hostel. You know, we go to all creeds and none. And wherever that patient's home is where we will facilitate and make it as peaceful as we can. So,
yeah,
that's what it's about.
As much as it can be. And yeah. I think having that team around us, you know, that staff there were just incredible, and I think of them to this day.
Yeah.
And they all came out and lined up as he left the nursing home for the last time. Yeah. And, you know, they were there with us every step of the way. Olive, when you were thinking of coming in here today, what was it that you really wanted to get across?
I suppose, like, one of the things would be, like, for people not to be afraid of us, as in there are so many positives to the hospice and what we can do for patients and families. And I think I would really like people to move away from that whole kind of sense of, like, hospice for the dying, because I think we are very focused on the living. Unfortunately, people that have complex need, so our patient group, you know, do have a lot of complexities and a lot of symptoms that we do need to work hard on to reverse and manage well for them. But I suppose, you know, we have absolutely got the expertise to do that. And I think, you know, the comfort that we can bring to patients and families, because we can really make a difference, you know, there's great comfort for us all in that. But I suppose it is important to say, like, as well, that the people that are referred to our service, like, we definitely, it's the people that have the complex symptom burden. So as Nora was saying, we do visit, you know, in different types of accommodation, and we visit nursing homes. And often, I suppose, we empower the staff within nursing homes to manage the person that is very ill or potentially coming towards end of life. We empower them to be able to manage those symptoms as they appear. And I suppose for many people, their symptom burden might be very low. So those people wouldn't require specialist palliative care service if they are naturally coming to end of life and their symptom burden is very low. It's more the generalist teams would be able to manage that very well. And I suppose families as well, I think it's important to say that we are constantly astounded by the work families do in the home, because most of our work, mine and Nora's, is visiting patients in their own home. That's the work that we do as community palliative care nurse specialists. But what families can pull out of the bag and achieve is unbelievable. And I'm forever in awe of that, even though we visit these families every day of the week. And I suppose it just reminds me a little bit when my own father was dying and my sister was living in Edinburgh. And I had phoned her and I said, Anne, I think it's time to come home. And my sister said to me after my father died, she said, what do the families do that don't have their own nurse? What do they do? And it's like, it really reminded me of like, oh my goodness, actually, you know, and I think that was, you know, quite a long time ago. But it was like, we expect quite a lot from families, but they always deliver, and they deliver in such an amazing way. And I think after their person dies, there is great comfort for them in the sense that what they were able to achieve. And I do think that helps them quite a lot in bereavement, you know, yeah, all they were able to do with, yeah, our support, of course, and with the other supports in the community, the Irish Cancer Society Night Nursing Service,
yeah,
you know, the public health nurse, the carers in the community. Like, so it's a collaborative approach. But there's great comfort, I think, for those families when they've been able to achieve that.
And so important to mention that, because that's the best of humanity. And I think we kind of talk about the human race being doomed, but there is so much more good than bad in this world. I always say that. I want to ask one more sensitive question, but as I have you both here, you're experts in this field. I did get a sense from my own experience with my dad that dying looked quite difficult. It looked quite challenging to him at times. And I've discussed it anecdotally with friends who felt the same at times in some ways. But is that part of the process? Does it have to be that way? I've already spoken about how helpful the nursing staff were. And, you know, if there was pain relief needed, it would be given. So I'm not really suggesting that. But I think when you see it in the movies, you know, the beep just goes flat. It can be challenging. Is that just very much part of it?
Well, it is a process. We do compare it to the process of labour. You have to labour to get a child into the world. And there is a process to getting out of the world. Now, with our current medications and our collaboration with all other specialities, it should be less laboursome. It shouldn't be a struggle for the patient. We've got wonderful medications that can help the patient's awareness be much less. So what looks to us to be a bothersome symptom, the patient isn't experiencing those feelings. So, but to answer you, yeah, it is a process that has to be got through, and we aim to make it as peaceful as we can.
Yeah, I think also in relation to that, like, you know, a lot of our work also would be anticipatory, so we can anticipate, you know, what's happening and, you know, as the person approaches or is approaching death. So as part of that anticipatory process, we do have medications on hand where at home families would be in a position to be able to give, you know, to manage, you know, distress or manage, you know, any, you know, symptoms that might become a little bit more apparent in the last maybe a couple of days of life. I suppose as part of our service, we visit every day. We are very good at responding. We have a service in St. Francis Hospice where we are on call up to 9 p.m. 365 days a year. And so we're very available, I suppose, to families. And when we can anticipate that, you know, X symptom might become a little bit more troublesome, that's where we will also make arrangements to have our night nurse going to the home at night time from 11 to 7.
Yeah, well, as I said at the outset, it's absolutely incredible work that you do. Thank you for coming in to tell us a little bit about it. Olive Finucane and Nora McCarrick, community palliative care nurses at St. Francis Hospice in Raheny in Dublin, who also support end-of-life patients in the home. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, to Hugo De Silva-Scott, who was on sound, Rory Galvin was on podcasts, and thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.